Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, average sea levels have risen more than 8 inches since 1880, with 3 of those inches gained in just the last 25 years. Along with the rising seas, we're seeing more frequent coastal flooding, erosion, and storm surges. What areas are at greatest risk, and what will our coastline look like when the seas have risen 1 foot? And what infrastructure, such as roads and buildings, will be impacted? A new planning tool developed by the Cape Cod Commission will help answer these and other questions as we prepare for rising waters. Today, we discuss the Cape Cod Coastal Planner and consider some of the choices we'll have to make as the ocean stakes a larger claim on our shorelines. Joining us is Christy Senatore. She's director of the Cape Cod Commission. Good morning, Christy.
Good morning, Mindy.
Aaron Perry, deputy director at the Commission. Good morning. To you, Aaron.
Good morning.
We also have in studio Greg Berman. He's the coastal process specialist at the Woods Hole Sea Grant and Cape Cod Cooperative Extension. He's on the advisory committee for the Cape Coast Planner, and data from his research contributed to the project. Welcome back. Good to see you, Greg.
Pleasure to be here.
And on the phone, we have Mark Borelli, director of coastal geology at the Center for Coastal Studies in Provincetown. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
So, Christy, let's start with what is the role of the Cape Cod Commission as we begin to address how sea level rise will impact our communities?
Several years ago, we applied for and received a grant through the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration really to look at the impacts from sea level rise, and that's called our Resilient Cape Cod Project, and it's really helping communities understand the threats under projected climate and sea level rise scenarios and to communicate some of the costs, and certainly the costs of doing nothing, but then the costs of potential strategies that communities might use to address some of these coastal threats.
Tell us a little bit more about the Commonwealth's Municipal Vulnerability Preparedness Program. That's a mouthful.
It is a mouthful. The state is absolutely taking a leadership role in looking at and addressing climate change and sea level rise, and they've established a program called the MVP program, and they're looking at providing funding for both planning and for communities to take action.
Mm. Aaron, the Cape Cod Coastal Planner is a really cool tool, actually. In a moment, we'll walk through more specifics. But in a nutshell, how does it work and what kinds of information is it designed to give us?
Sure. So the Cape Cod Coastal Planner was really designed as both a communication and an educational tool, as well as a decision support tool. And so its intent is to educate users on climate change impacts that our region faces and some of the adaptation strategies available to address them, as well as the implications on both local infrastructure as well as the ecosystems in the region. And so it provides information on the various hazards that we face. It includes GIS data layers on the infrastructure on the ground, as well as the ecosystems on the ground and the extent of those along the entire shoreline. And then it includes a database of information relative to all of the different adaptation strategies that might be available to communities to address those.
So give us a little background on how long the Coastal Planner has been under development and the stakeholders involved.
Sure. So the process has really been ongoing for about 3 years now. As Christy mentioned, we received the NOAA grant back in 2016. We started the process by engaging an advisory committee to really guide and provide feedback on the overall project. We engaged a science committee that was made up of primarily government and academic experts that was able to identify the appropriate kind of science and information that should go into the Resilient Cape Cod Project and the tool, as well as an adaptation strategies committee, some technical experts that could provide information on the different strategies available. And so that really started 3 years ago. About a year and a half ago is when the real dedicated development began on the tool, and we engaged stakeholders from across the region. We had four sub-regional kind of stakeholder working groups organized based on kind of the segments of shoreline that they're most connected to. And they provided feedback both on some of the assumptions that went into the tool as well as the functionality. So that was a broader stakeholder process. And then about a year or so ago, we engaged a more dedicated group focused on tool development specifically. And they were our tool users group, and they met for several months to guide development of the tool.
Greg, remind us of the focus of your work and how you contributed to the Coastal Planner tool.
Sure. So I primarily provide technical assistance to local homeowner groups, to town officials, to conservation commissions, DNRs, that sort of thing. And it's taking the best available science, trying to get it to the coastal managers. And as such, I'll weigh in on a lot of coastal stabilization and adaptation to sea level rise proposals. And so we have a pretty wide range of adaptation measures that are being used on Cape Cod in Massachusetts. So some of the things I did to help out on the committees for this tool was to kind of go through the very large matrix of adaptation measures, try to kind of winnow those down to some of the more feasible ones, and also looking at sediment transport around Cape Cod and kind of vetting some of the aspects of the public-facing look of the tool.
Mark, tell us a little bit about your work at the Center for Coastal Studies.
Well, we do quite a bit of work along the coast in the Marine Geology Department at the center. We're doing pure science and applied science, doing some seafloor mapping, trying to understand what's at the bottom of the seafloor in terms of the coastal physical processes and ecosystems and things like that. But we have been doing more and more resiliency projects where we're working with towns and the commission and Greg to sort of take that science and apply it and help the towns make decisions and then implement those decisions in terms of what to do for very site-specific projects.
Yeah. Tell us why it's important for us to know about the geology of our region as we grapple with how to address rising sea levels.
That's a great question. I think it's really important to understand that the way waves and tides interact with a particular coast can be very specific. There's general principles that we all understand, but and particularly in places where it's been developed, where there's structures or potential for structures or questions about proposals that look into how to address certain issues in particular places, it's critical to understand what that the literal foundation of that particular area is, right? Mm-hmm. We want to understand what processes are most important in these areas because they do vary, how those structures or potential structures can interfere with the processes, the natural processes. And I think the tool that the commission has developed is a great place to start, right? Mm-hmm. It's a really good place to understand what's going on, what are the potentials. I've spent some time with the tool, and I think it's really effective at conveying the complexity because it is very complex, and the tool is very dense. It has multiple layers, but I think it's a great way to start that conversation.
You know, as you're talking, I'm thinking, you know, when you have a history of areas, I'm thinking of some places that might have been low-lying that, you know, if you grew up in Syria, you went, hey, that always floods, and it doesn't flood now, and somebody's kind of filled it in and built a house on top of that. Knowing that history is really important, right, because you may think that you're in an area that's maybe not as vulnerable as it could be, right?
Again, it's a great point, Mindy. And Graham Guys is one of the founders of the center. Has that sort of institutional knowledge.
Yep.
And he's been talking to me about all these things. I've been here for 10 years at the center. Graham's been here for over 40. And it's really important when we talk about management and tools like the commission has put together, that encapsulates some of that. It looks at how developed an area is and what some of the history is that has been. And then you have experts like Greg and who've been here for quite a while. Greg's been here as long as I have. And he's sort of in the field. He's always looking at these different areas. So this combination of science and management and resiliency is a wonderful one, I think.
Yeah, and I think kind of building on that is we have institutional knowledge and where science kind of takes the reins is going back before we have institutional knowledge. So, I mean, 6,000 years ago, most models show that you could have walked from the village here in Woods Hole over to Nantucket and not gotten your feet wet.
Right.
So that in conjunction with a lot of fairly major hurricanes back in the 15, 1600s and even earlier, that we just don't have the records over the last 100 years to show, but there were significant differences in the past. And if we had this level of infrastructure in the middle of Nantucket Sound, it certainly wouldn't look like it does now.
I was going to, you mentioned Graham, and boy, if you can take 10 minutes and sit down with, probably take more than 10 minutes, but he's fascinating to just go over the history of what's happened along the coastline. Yeah,
yep,
for sure. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So I don't know if this is a question for Greg or Mark. Is it complicated to predict sea level rise? I mean, you know, because you hear different things, and, you know, I think people sometimes don't really understand when you say, oh, it's a foot. They go, they're not really understanding what that means, right?
Yeah, and Greg, you jump in, but I think part of the issue is there's global sea level rise and then relative sea level rise. Mm-hmm. And those are two different things. One is the global sea level rise is the sea level rise that we're going to see everywhere around the world. It's going to be equal around the world. And then relative sea level rise is going to vary based on where you are. And unfortunately, in the Northeast, we're going to see a higher rate of that relative sea level rise than many other places around the world. But I think it's important to understand any prediction has uncertainty, mm-hmm. and that is one of the toughest things we deal with is conveying uncertainty to the public.
Right.
There's any prediction you make, and I like to make a joke and say if you're going to measure a 12-inch ruler with another 12-inch ruler, there's going to be uncertainty. That's just the way it works.
Yeah. Go ahead, Greg.
And kind of building on that communication of uncertainty, this state has put out a couple of downscaled sea level rise projections over the last one in 2013, one in 2018, and we've kind of moved away from scenario-based communication to probabilistic communication. Mm-hmm. So instead of looking at kind of best case and worst case scenarios, now they're just looking at one scenario and basing probabilities on that. Mm-hmm. And one of the dangers of trying to communicate that can be looking at the 2100 is where most of the projections go out to. That's where the highest difference between the various probabilities are. And some of the more recent, the 2018 projections, will often be tossed around 4 to 10 feet by 2100. Well, between 8 and 10 feet is about a 0.04% probability change, right? So, I mean, 8 feet, you are 99.5% sure it's not going to be worse than that. 10 feet, you're 99.9% sure it's not going to be worse than that. So when you start getting at that upper range of uncertainty, it's not necessarily that valuable as a coastal management tool. But if you can kind of communicate that, yeah, there is a very wide range and we're not doing our best guess anymore. We're doing our look at seeing our level of what we're willing to put up with for uncertainty.
Yeah. Go ahead, Christy.
And I think also when we developed the tool, it's really developed as a decision support tool for communities and stakeholders in the region. It's not a predictive analytical tool, but it provides enough information that people can project their own potential sea level rise scenarios onto a certain area and determine what some of the impacts would be and what some of the strategies would be that communities could decide to implement if they wanted to, so that it's not predicting the amount of sea level rise, but taking into account if it were X feet in a different area, what some of those implications
would
be.
What it would look like, yeah. Because when you say a foot, people have this vision in their mind of what they think of a foot of sea level rise is, and it's probably not accurate of what they're thinking, right? And that's a hard thing to communicate to people, right?
Right, and that foot's over the last 100 years, right? So that's our actually observed rate in this area. And, I mean, that's probably one of the hardest mental regimes to get around,
right?
Is things aren't going to be the same in the future as they have been for the last 100 years. We've seen an increase, and it's just the slope of that line of increase that is based on the uncertainty of various choices that we make.
Yeah, and you see it all the time, Greg. Every time there's a storm, we usually call you when you're out on the beaches kind of checking out the erosion. And I imagine you've seen quite a bit in the decade that you've been here, some big changes.
Right? Oh, yeah. Yeah, significantly. Yeah. I mean, within 10 years, you're really not going to see sea level rise.
Right.
So, I mean,
you're
talking...
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's all based on we've had this level of sea level rise. We're starting to get closer to infrastructure that's not moving back.
Mm-hmm.
And so our beaches are already pretty low in a lot of areas just due to the, you know, non-natural, lack of natural retreat in the area. So you're seeing enhanced erosion. You're seeing interruption of sediment transport. And all that's kind of based on sea level rise. If sea level was falling, our beaches would be going further out. But that's not the regime we've been in for tens of thousands of years.
You're listening to The Point. We're talking about sea level rise, also more frequent coastal flooding, erosion, and storm surges, and a new planning tool developed by the Cape Cod Commission that will help prepare for rising waters. In studio with us is Christy Senatori, Director of the Cape Cod Commission, Aaron Perry, Deputy Director of the Commission, Greg Berman, Coastal Process Specialist at the Woods Hole Sea Grant and Cape Cod Cooperative Extension, and Mark Borelli, Director of Coastal Geology at the Center for Coastal Studies in Provincetown. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to chime in. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So there are a series of layers for the Cape Cod Coastal Planner tool that we're going to illustrate for us, I guess. Let's start with the vulnerability ribbon. It will show what low, medium, and high. So what does the vulnerability mean in this context?
Sure. The Vulnerability Ribbon was developed based on a model from South Carolina, the Beach Vulnerability Index. And what it allows is for kind of an at-a-glance look of relative vulnerability of different segments of the shoreline. And so it takes into account, ecosystems within that particular area, infrastructure in that area, homes, mm-hmm. Other development in that area, municipal infrastructure. So it takes into account kind of infrastructure that serves the public versus private infrastructure. It looks at, recreational uses in the area and other aspects of the coastline that might impact the community. And so it is able to provide a relative vulnerability so that a user could identify kind of the highest vulnerability areas when they're looking at the tool.
Right. Describe how the sea level rise planning layer of the tool works.
Sure. So the sea level rise, if you're familiar, we had a sea level rise viewer at the commission that was developed some years ago, and it allows a user to identify a particular level of sea level rise anywhere from 1 to 6 feet. So you can toggle back and forth between 1 foot and 6 feet and look at the impact not only on the area that becomes inundated, but also on the roadways that would be disconnected given that level of sea level rise, as well as the critical facilities that are impacted.
All right. So what is a disconnected road, and what are some examples of the critical facilities that the tool includes?
Sure. Disconnected roads are roadways that would become flooded or impassable should sea level rise. They're proximate to the coast, so areas that would be inundated with sea level rise. The critical facilities are facilities that are identified through each town's hazard mitigation planning process. So the commission has worked with the majority of towns on that over the last 5 or so years to develop local hazard mitigation plans. Critical facilities are things like hospitals and police stations, fire stations, schools, mm-hmm. Areas where people might congregate or where emergency services are available.
And there's also an infrastructure planning layer that has a lot of information for both private landowners and towns. So what's included in that layer?
Sure. That layer includes municipal properties, public and private roads, sewered parcels, parcels with wastewater infrastructure or water infrastructure on them, coastal defense structures, as well as private structures.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, Greg, there's a tab in the infrastructure section that identifies coastal defense structures, groins, revetments, jetties. Describe these structures and why their location is important.
So a lot of these structures are usually defined as coastal engineering structures under the state law. But what they can do is have an impact on the natural coastal processes. So there's two main reasons to build one of these. One is to prevent perpendicular erosion, which means your shoreline is retreating, moving landward. Your house or wastewater facility is in the way, so you want to stabilize that shoreline to prevent loss of the upland and that infrastructure. What that can do is that's taking away the natural sediment that's coming from that system back onto the beach. So downdrift beaches are not going to get the material that would have gone into the system that way. And also, when you do that, the land can project further into the water than adjacent areas, which can focus some wave energy. Mm. The other main direction is parallel to shore. So the groins and jetties, kind of, we'll see a lot of those on the Nantucket Sound shoreline of Cape Cod. The idea for that is the jetties are intended to stop sediment transport, to keep it out of the navigation channel. Groins are intended to slow down that sediment transport. So you get buildup on one side, but that obviously deprives sediment on the other side. And in a lot of areas that are kind of deprived of sediment from one type of structure, you get almost complete stoppage of sediment flow by the other structure.
Yeah. So it seems like we've talked a little about erosion. We know that sand moves along the coast in a fairly predictable way. Explain the movement of sand and how sea level rise is changing the process.
So basically, sea level rise is the elevation on which the water, wind, and waves intersect the shoreline. So if you have a certain elevation, you're going to get sediment transport in one direction. If you increase the rate of that sea level rise, very kind of theoretically, you're going to increase the rate of erosion and transport. In fact, Mark did a very nice study in Pleasant Bay looking at various rates of sea level rise and what that was going to do on the migration of that barrier beach system.
Go ahead, Mark. I'm sure you want to chime in here, too.
Yeah, no, it's very important. And one of the things I always talk about when I talk about sea level rise is I think the main way we're going to see impacts of sea level rise is during storm events, mm-hmm. right? So when people say, well, what's going to happen and what's the big deal if it's half a foot, a few inches of sea level rise every so often or over a period of time, you have to imagine, so the last January, the storm of record, right, the last big blizzard in January of 2018, it's a new storm of record beyond the blizzard of 78. Now, imagine a foot of sea level rise on top of that storm, right? Mm-hmm. And imagine another foot of water. That was as big a storm as we've ever gotten here. It's a new storm of record, and just a little bit of sea level rise would have made a huge difference.
Yeah.
So the way sediment transport is changed or altered is that the waves come closer to shore, bigger waves come closer to shore, the more erosion happens because, as Greg was saying, all those processes are stacked on top of whatever the water level is. So with increasing sea level rise, bigger waves get closer to shore and have more of an impact.
And the final layer of the Cape Cod Coastal Planner tool is inundation. What kinds of information does that layer give?
Sure. That includes the flood zones identified by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, as well as the National Weather Service SLOSH, which is the sea, lake, and overland surges from hurricanes layer, which is developed based on historical hurricane data.
So, Christy, can the planning tool be modified or updated with new information as we continue to collect data associated with sea level rise?
Absolutely. And so that's part of the goal behind developing this tool is we want it to be able to consume new and available data as we get more and better information.
There are so many different planning layers in the Cape Cod Coastal Planner. It's easy to maybe add too much information. So what's your advice on starting to use the tool? Because you can all of a sudden go, whoa, how much do I want to know?
Yeah, the tool actually consumes and uses a lot of data and information, but we're trying to make the user components of it as friendly as possible so that while it's intended for decision makers, you know, the general public and stakeholders could also go on and take a look at the tool and try to find out what some of the impacts would be in their particular region.
What kind of timeline should towns be looking at as we assess vulnerability and response? 20 years, 40 years, 100 years? You know, what are we planning for the next event like a hurricane? Or, you know, what are thoughts on that?
Well, the Coastal Planner is looking at about a 40-year horizon on sea level. And so some of the short-term implications and long-term implications need to be considered, though, as local communities plan. In general, planning for climate change is more over the long term, but there are some incremental changes that communities and the general public can make in strategic locations. Communities can look at potentially changing their zoning, creating incentives for areas where it might be beneficial to reduce the number of vulnerable properties in these areas.
Mm-hmm. So what factors should we consider as we analyze a short-term versus a long-term approach?
Certainly the amount of infrastructure in a particular area and the lifetime of a particular infrastructure in relation to some of the hazards that might be posed in those areas. You know, replacing certain types of infrastructure, whether it's a revetment or a seawall, are certainly significant infrastructure challenges that would have certainly a longer lifespan.
Yeah, and I guess in answer to your first question, yes. I mean, the multi-stage planning levels, planning for short, middle, and long term. And then, I mean, all of that is kind of the planner's mm-hmm. range. When you start looking geologically, I mean, it's an entirely different story, right?
Right.
So, I mean, if we're talking 1,000 years, then no, none of these strategies are going to work. And most homeowners will be like, well, yeah, I acknowledge that my home won't be here in 1,000 years. It's trying to nail down somewhere between like 10 and 1,000 years.
Right.
It can be difficult for people to wrap their heads around.
Yeah. In the face of rising sea level and changes in flood mapping, many homeowners are raising their homes. Given what we know of how the shoreline of the Cape and Islands moves and shifts, how is this a long-term solution, raising structures, or are we just, you know, delaying the inevitable? What are your thoughts on that? Anybody?
Well, it's extending the lifespan of the property, right? So pretty much anything we do to try to increase resiliency on a parcel level. It's trying to increase the lifespan of that particular property, keep it on the tax base as long as possible. But at the same time, having as little impact on the coastal resources as possible. And that's kind of the line that we straddle when we're trying to do these kinds of resilience projects is one trying to, you know, help the private property owner and the upland, and at the same time, not degrading the marsh or beach or shoreline, whatever's on the seaward side of that property.
Erin? I think just adding and agreeing with Greg, but it really depends on where the structure is. You know, there are some areas where it might make sense to elevate that maybe face just occasional flooding right now, and there are others that may have just a very short-term benefit. And, you know, one of the things that the coastal planner can help with is being able to just educate and show some of the information and the potential predictions and allow for people to identify some of the areas where it might not make sense.
Dikes have long been used to control floodwaters. Would that approach be feasible in our region? Are there other options for controlling floodwaters? Anybody have thoughts?
I think dikes have significant natural resources impacts, and they definitely impact the natural functions of our coast. So there may be some areas that would be limited that may, dikes may be helpful in these areas, but at a large scale, construction of dikes probably wouldn't be something that would be implemented on the Cape. There's certainly loss of beaches, salt marshes, and impacts to water quality, depending on how and where these are located.
Great. Yeah, and with any project like this, like, you have to end it somewhere. Mm-hmm. So where you end it, if you're preventing water from going into a certain area, that means you're displacing it to the sides. Same thing with erosion and revetments and seawalls and that kind of thing. You have to end it somewhere, and that area on the end usually sees accentuated impacts due to that protection.
How does available federal and state funding influence how municipalities address rising sea levels?
I think it has a huge impact. You know, any of these projects are hugely expensive to the community, if it's a larger scale project or even to a homeowner. You know, Massachusetts, as Christy mentioned, is really taking a leadership role in the Municipal Vulnerability Preparedness Program by providing funding for planning and education as well as action. So I think, at least in terms of the Cape, we've seen a lot of increased dialogue and increased action as a result of the funding that the state's providing.
Yeah. So, is there grant money to elevate an infrastructure? I mean, is it more likely that a town will do that instead of moving infrastructure, even if elevating only buys a little bit of time? One is more costly than the other. I mean, are all those factors just kind of weighed and you figure what makes the most sense for now? How does that work?
I think all those factors are taken into consideration, and we have 15 individual communities on the Cape that are still making 15 individual decisions. But what the coastal planner also looks at is areas of vulnerability that transcend boundaries. So it's not as though you're looking at only solutions for your particular town. So we're hoping that some of these towns will continue to cooperate and come up with solutions that are best for the Cape coastline rather than the individual municipalities.
Yeah, and a lot of these shorelines are wildly different on Cape Cod, right? I mean, if we think about Cape Cod Bay, we have a 10-foot tide range. A 1 foot of sea level is about 10% of that. Mm-hmm. If we go down to Nantucket Sound, it's closer to 33% of that change. So you're going to see potentially a greater impact on sea level rise there than you might up north. So there's a lot of very site-specific things that have to be taken into account for any kind of project.
So aside from available funding, what are some of the other considerations municipalities weigh when choosing whether to abandon or move an infrastructure or modify?
I think going back to the lifespan of the infrastructure, the communities have to consider the necessity of the infrastructure, whether they need to construct it in that location. That, you know, we're talking a lot about wastewater infrastructure, and where does it make the most sense to build some of these larger infrastructure projects, and given that we know sea level is rising, you know, where do they want to construct that so that there are long-term implications? So there's lots of considerations at the local level.
Yeah, okay, I don't know if anybody knows the answer to this, but do you know what a town's legal responsibilities are to maintain roadways in an area that's flooded, particularly such abandonment results in, like, a private landowners losing access to their property? Do we know? I mean, I'm thinking of, for one, Surf Drive here in Falmouth. It always, you know, floods a lot. Roads always being repaired, it seems. They've done a little bit of modification. I think it's not quite as bad as it was for a while there. But, you know, at some point you go, okay, how many times can you fix this road? And then if you close the road, whatever properties there are on that road, you don't have access to. So there's a lot that goes, I mean, you can see why you want to try to keep fixing it, but there's going to come a point where that's not going to be feasible, right?
So I think in most of these cases, it depends. Yeah. And I think you're looking at some private infrastructure, you're looking at personal homeowner rights, but you're also looking at some state roadways. And so there's a lot of potential players that go into that legal conversation about what the next step should be.
Mm-hmm. So it's a complicated process is what you're saying.
Yeah. In most cases.
Yeah. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about sea level rise and more frequent coastal flooding, erosion, storm surges, and a new planning tool developed by the Cape Cod Commission that will help prepare for rising waters. With us in studio is Christy Senatori, Director of the Cape Cod Commission, Aaron Perry, Deputy Director of the Commission, Greg Berman, he's the Coastal Processes Specialist at the Woods Hole Sea Grant and Cape Cod Cooperative Extension, and on the phone, Mark Borelli, Director of Coastal Geology at the Center for Coastal Studies in Provincetown. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you have a comment or a question, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So waterfront properties, obviously the most valuable and the most vulnerable. So what are the revenue implications for towns that begin to lose private properties to flooding and rising sea level? I mean, you touched, I think, earlier, Greg, on the tax base. I mean, what are the implications here?
So we've done some analysis because this is a really important question, and the revenue considerations are certainly great. 19% of the Cape is in a flood hazard area, which if you do the math, it's a total of more than $28 billion in assessed property value. So that includes about 13,000 single-family homes. So these are significant numbers. Hmm. So these coastal properties provide significant tax revenue for the communities. And certainly if this is lost, some of those costs would shift.
Yeah. Now, there are some who might argue that taxpayer dollars shouldn't be used to protect expensive pieces of private property or access to expensive properties, but even if it means a loss of revenue for the town, what do you think should inform these debates and these kinds of decisions?
Well, as much information as we can provide, it primarily for, flood damage, that kind of thing. It's going to be FEMA's National Flood Insurance Program, which caps out at $250,000. So if you have a multi-million-dollar home, you are not going to be made whole by the federal government. Mm-hmm. That said, there are certain subsidies still in place that the government has been trying to wean us off of for some time. And it is heading more towards actuarial rates. The idea of the federal flood insurance is not to make the multi-million-dollar homes whole. It's to be able to provide federal mortgages for the 13,000 homeowners on Cape Cod and other parts of the country.
Right. You mentioned FEMA flood maps, and there's been some controversy over those maps where some people felt like they were put in a vulnerable area where maybe they didn't feel like their property really was. Where do we stand with that? Do you know? I mean, is everybody kind of happy with the results now, or are we still seeing people who think that those maps are not accurate? Anybody know?
I think everybody who got placed in a flood area might not be happy anymore. I mean, the best case scenario is you were taken out or just outside of it, which, these are flood insurance rate maps. They aren't designed to guarantee your safety. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is a line on the ground or a line on that map where you don't need to have federal flood insurance for a mortgage.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that you won't see storm impacts.
Yeah.
But once you're on the other side of the line, it's a lot cheaper to get that federal flood insurance. I want to say, I don't have the exact numbers, but a third to half of damage in these storms are not within the special flood hazard areas. So it's a good idea to get flood insurance, especially if you're right on the other side of the line. It's usually pretty cheap and you're still pretty, that's the 1% chance line.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be a much higher storm than that. It's just that's the 1% chance.
Right. That's one thing about storms. They're unpredictable, right? We don't really know what's going to happen. All right, so there's a case on Nantucket where a group of homeowners in Sconset want to expand an erosion control project at the base of the bluff that's eroding. I believe the homeowners would pay for the project, but the Nantucket Conservation Commission has denied the extension out of concern, among other things, that the tubing used to prevent erosion of the bluffs would accelerate erosion in other areas. The issue is now before the State Department of Environmental Protection and Nantucket Superior Court. So, Greg and Mark, can you describe how these geotubes are used, what they are?
Yeah, these geotubes, they're long tubes, usually made out of some kind of plastic. Sometimes it's burlap, depending on what kind of fiber is needed for the energy regime and the permitting process, things like that. But they're really hard. They're rock hard. They're soft structures. I'm using air quotes here, but and they're soft structures because if they break, the sand that's in them will sort of just leak out. So it's not a permanent solution. But they behave as if they're hard structures, right? They will cause, and Greg mentioned this earlier, it's pretty much settled science that if you put a vertical structure on an eroding beach, it's going to accelerate that erosion, right? Mm-hmm. That it's going to be worse. Now you have the end effects, or the edge effects, and what happens is when you end a project, because somewhere you have to end the project, there is accelerated erosion at those ends because right at the end of that, you have this incoming wave energy that was causing erosion prior to the installation of this feature. And some of that wave energy gets redirected to the unarmored bank or bluff. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem, is that once you build one of these, where do you end it and how do you end it? Mm-hmm. So what they want to do in this particular project is extend the edges or both ends of the project to provide more protection to the bluff. But again, where do you end the project, right? Mm-hmm. That's this perpetual problem that these structures have to end at some point. So that's a big sticking point, and it's a big problem.
Yeah. And I think earlier they've done some, like, beach replenishment programs. And so any of these options that we're looking at, there's not long-term. I mean, these are only temporary, right? Mother Nature is going to do what Mother Nature wants. Is that right?
That's a really important point, is that when you do these manipulations, whether they're hard structures, soft structures, or even beach replenishment projects, you're signing on to do this in perpetuity because mm-hmm. the processes at work that led to the need for whatever project you decide to do are always going to be there, yeah. right? The waves and the currents and the storms are always going to be there, and with sea level rise, those things will amplify the erosion and things like that. So when it's important when people understand when you put sand on a beach, this is a temporary solution, and you're going to have to keep doing it. And it only varies, quite frankly, on the frequency of the storm events and yeah. strength.
And with the replenishment programs, just for a second, you can't just put any kind of sand, is that right? Does it have to kind of match the sand that's there? I mean, when you're digging some sand offshore and bringing it, it's not that simple, right?
No, it's very complicated. We learned the lesson a long time ago about grain size and composition, where they're used to, when we were dredging an area, we'd just say, hey, we'll take this material and put it on a beach. But if it's not the right grain size, if it's too fine, then that'll wash away much faster than it normally would if it were similar grain sizes on the beach. The other problem is that folks have a natural tendency to want to put sand that's a little bit coarser because they think it's going to last longer, mm. right? But if that beach could support that grain size of sand, it would be there, right? So what you're going to do is you're going to alter the way that beach behaves or responds to the incoming wave energy and tides. So it's very tricky, and it needs to be very specific in terms of grain size.
Yeah, and kind of following up on that, too, is a lot of the hard structures, the revetments, the geotubes, those kind of things, will have a requirement to keep them covered with sand, mm-hmm. right? And so that's to try to prevent the hard structure from interacting with the waves. That's going to get more and more expensive over time because sea level's increasing. It's going to be kind of artificially offshore, and you may need more and more material to keep it covered. Mm-hmm. When we start thinking about that, a lot of the open coastal projects see higher erosion rates, but it's not as big a deal relatively about how much material you put on there. When you start getting in estuarine areas, it can become much more of an issue that if you're trying to keep a revetment covered and you keep getting sand going into the system, estuaries are relatively short-lived geologic features to begin with. They tend to fill up, whether it's sand coming from the ocean or sand coming from the inland or riverine portion. So when we start And when we keep adding material to the system, it can be an issue if it's eroding more quickly and starting to fill up navigation channels and affecting mm-hmm. resource areas.
Yeah. What about, we talked a little bit about seawalls and jetties, and there's certainly lots of rules around that now from what we've learned of where you can and cannot put these things. If a homeowner wanted to just put up a seawall or a jetty, they're not allowed to do that, right? Or are you?
Well, no, there are stipulations, right? So the Wetlands Protection Act moved into the coastal realm back in 1978. So if you had a house on your property At that time, you would likely be grandfathered in and potentially allowed a coastal engineering structure if your house is in danger and if you're on a glacial landform and if it's not going to affect some other coastal resource areas. So there's a lot of ifs involved, but there's not a hard no unless you happen to be like in a dune or beach or something like that.
Yeah. Does it?
It's very difficult to get those kinds of structures permitted in Massachusetts, one of the toughest states. It happens, but it is rare.
Yeah. So does the planning tool take into consideration any of that, like seawalls and jetties and things?
So the planning tool takes into consideration some of the points that Greg made. So it doesn't allow you necessarily. So in kind of the simplest example, you can't do beach nourishment in an area that doesn't have a beach. Mm-hmm. So it does apply some of those kind of guiding principles so that you can't make choices that would be impossible.
Yeah. So, Mark, what about the jetties and seawalls and things that exist now? Obviously, if they were to go away, that would change the process, right? So, you know, is there an effort to do that, or do we just, you know, kind of grandfather in what's already there? How does that work?
There are some efforts, actually, like the sort of dam removal community or movement. There are some folks in towns that are talking about removing some of the older groins that are just not really functioning anymore. The, you know, people around the Cape will go to a certain beach, many beaches, where these groins are just sort of rocks in the intertidal zone. They're not really doing their job anymore. So there is some towns who are talking about maybe removing these things. There's also factions who want to sort of beef them up and build them as if, because you could do maintenance on these structures and then beef them up. So there is an understanding now that these structures don't always have the intended effect, and they often have unintended consequences that accelerate erosion immediately downdrift.
Yeah, sometimes cheaper than actually removing the structure itself, and it's going to be much more expensive to remove it than it was to construct it originally. Folks will, it's called notching, where you'll go in and remove certain rocks at a certain beach elevation that will allow sand to flow through on the impounded side down to the downdrift side that's being deprived of sand. Mm-hmm. So that's just one aspect of kind of adapting or adjusting some of these structures as opposed to full removal.
Yeah. And some of the, like the canal with the issue in Sandwich, that's, I mean, there really isn't a good solution there, is there? Sandwich has that big erosion problem, and partially because of the canal, right?
Oh, yeah. Definitely. And I mean, one of the kind of sticking points in my mind is if you were going to build a new jetty, you would be required to have a bypass system to get sand past that jetty. But there's been a lot of efforts. Mark's been involved for a number of years also to try to get a bypass system. Whereas if you were going to construct a new one, you would be required to put it in. Mm-hmm. So it's difficult permitting wise to do the right thing, quote unquote.
Yeah. Mark, your thoughts on that?
It is a big problem, and I think Greg's absolutely right that if a new project were to be designed and developed, you'd have to make sure that you aren't going to have any negative impacts downdrift. There are other groups, like Town of Chatham is a perfect example of a group where they're taking sediment from an area there's a problem with deposition, right, near an inlet where they have too much sand, and they take it and they bypass it, right, so they don't put it on the other side of the inlet. They'll take it and they'll put it a mile or two updrift and let into Town of Chatham, let that sand come back down naturally. So this is a cycle of removal where there's a deposition problem near an inlet, and then you put it in a place where there's an erosion problem, and that sand will slowly move down, and every once in a while they have to go back and do it. But there are all these innovative solutions and ideas that we have to sort of balance. The biggest thing at the coast is competing interests, is different stakeholders having different agendas and interests, and that's the thing that's probably the trickiest thing to do. We kind of know what to do at the coast. The problem is getting it done.
Yeah. So do we have enough reliable data to ascertain what areas of our coastline just can't be saved? I'm thinking of the Gay Head Cliffs and Aquinnah seem to be grappling with that same problem as Sconset. Is it just, you know, what's going to happen is going to happen? Do we come to a point where we just can't save certain areas?
Yeah, well, so there's a couple caveats there. Depends on what you mean by save, right? Glacial. Mm-hmm. So I think of places like the Vineyard in Nantucket. These are primarily glacial features, right? There's little barrier islands, barrier spits here and there. But these glacial, this material was emplaced by the glaciers, right? So that material is going to erode. That's what it's kind of there for, right? It's going to erode. It's not coming back. It's not a dune. It's not a beach. It doesn't go and coming back. So these things are erosional landforms. So the question becomes, if you want to protect that landform, sure, we can protect that. We can protect it from erosion forever, right? But we have to build walls around it, and we'd have to forget about having a beach in front of it. So protecting the landform is not hard. Any engineer will tell you he can do any, he or she can do anything, given enough time and money. But the question becomes, what do you want to give up for that, for protecting that landform? And you will give up a lot.
I think, just as Mark said, it really comes down to the community's values. And so the Cape Cod Coastal Planner allows you to take a look, at least at a high level, about what some of the implications might be, not only on the infrastructure in an area that you may or may not want to save or protect, but then also what the natural resources and the ecosystems are in that particular area, and, you know, weigh the costs and benefits of one action over another.
So it can be overwhelming to consider how our coastline will change in the next 50 to 100 years, but there are often opportunities amongst challenges. So where do you see the opportunities as we make ourselves more resilient to rising seas?
Well, Massachusetts has, or Cape Cod has, a third of the Massachusetts coastline, and we have the attention of the state administration, the leadership, and they are providing funding and they're paying attention to the coastline and the changes that were that are happening in the entire state, but certainly on the Cape. And so I think there's opportunity there. Unlike other planning processes, this is one that will continue, like you said, over the next 50 to 100 years and beyond that. This isn't an issue that we'll, we can address and it will go away. So I think we've shown a history of coming together as one Cape in the past over certain infrastructure issues and planning. And I think this is one area where we have 15 committed communities that can work together as one region to kind of address these issues and continue working with our state and federal partners as well.
Anybody else?
I'll say, I mean, we're seeing this issue come out in all of the planning work that we do. We just completed an update to our Cape Cod Economic Development Strategy. And one of the key priorities and associated initiatives and projects that came out of that process was around a climate change innovation kind of center and a coastal resiliency effort to look at new ways to address some of the issues that we face, getting others involved, builders and the real estate community, and thinking about, how we adapt moving forward and kind of what actions we might take, maybe what new building materials could be used to better address some of these issues.
I just have about a little over a minute left, and I'm just kind of going back to that kind of public education thought, where people are confused about what sea level rise means. You know, you're seeing more flooding, erosion, storms, that kind of thing. Do you feel like the general public is paying attention to this? Is it a tough message to get out?
I think it's like climate change in a way. Obviously, it's related, but there's two kind of groups of people, and there's sometimes you're just overwhelmed.
Yeah.
There's so much information. It feels like gloom and doom, and people don't know what to do. And the other people maybe not aren't Mindy, like you were saying, they don't really understand what's going on, and that's part of our job to get them to understand. But it can be daunting.
Yeah. All right, well, we'll have a link to the Cape Cod Commission so they can check out the planning tool. Christy Senatore, Director of the Cape Cod Commission, Aaron Perry, Deputy Director of the Commission, Greg Berman, Coastal Process Specialist at the Woods Hole Sea Grant and Cape Cod Cooperative Extension, and Mark Borelli, Director of Coastal Geology at the Center for Coastal Studies in Provincetown. Thanks so much to all of you for the important work that you do. We appreciate that and appreciate your time this morning. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.